Iran's President Raisi and Armenian Prime Minister Pashinyan highlight the need for sustainable peace and security in the Caucasus region. Russia says it's considering further steps in response to an attack on the Nord Stream undersea gas pipelines that it blames on London. War is intensifying the U.S. over growing political violence ahead of next week's midterm elections. This is World News. I'm Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. The top story this hour, President Ibrahim Raisi stresses his country's stance that a dispute between Armenia and Azerbaijan in the Caucasus region should be resolved by regional players. Raisi was speaking in a joint presser with the visiting Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan, and that after the two officials held talks on expanding bilateral ties. The president said that any foreign interference in the Caucasus would only add to regional problems. He also said that peace and security in the region are of prime significance for Tehran. He talked about the bilateral relations with Armenia as well. Raisi said that achieving the target trade of $3 billion with the country is possible if the two sides show determination. Pashinyan also echoed Raisi on the need for sustainable peace and security in the Caucasus region. Iran has slapped sanctions on 10 American officials and four entities over human rights violations and supporting terrorism. Let's take a look at some of those blacklisted individuals.
General Michael Eric Kurilla, commander of U.S. Central Command. Lieutenant General Gregory Gillett, deputy commander of U.S. Central Command. Scott Dozermu, commander of U.S. Airbase in Erbil. Anne Neuberger, Deputy National Security Advisor for Cyber and Emerging Technology. Major General Isaac Johnson, Jr., Commander of U.S. Army Civil Affairs and Psychological Operations Command.
The Iranian Foreign Ministry says that the target individuals and entities interfered in Iran's internal affairs, instigated violence and riots, and committed economic terrorism against the Iranian people. Those on the blacklist include the U.S. Deputy Secretary of the Treasury, the CIA, and the U.S. National Guard. Over the past few weeks, the U.S. and its Western allies have imposed several rounds of sanctions on Tehran over what they call crackdown on anti-government protests. Iran dismisses the allegation and says it's dealing with foreign-backed rioters. The U.S. Special Envoy for Iran says that Washington would resort to military action if necessary to prevent the Islamic Republic from obtaining a nuclear weapon.
Now, there are other tools, sanctions, pressure, and yes, as the president has said, if all other means fail as a last resort, he would keep the military option very clearly on the table if that's what it would take to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon.
The Mali dialed up anti-Iran rhetoric and military threat while speaking at an event organized by American think tank Carnegie Endowment. He clarified that there has been no movement on Washington rejoining the Iran nuclear deal since late August or early September. He said that the U.S. will not, quote, waste time on a deal if nothing is going to happen. The 2015 deal, also known as the JCPOA, was left in tatters after Washington withdrew from it in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Tehran. Talks to revive the JCPOA began in April last year between Iran and the remaining signatories, with the U.S. participating indirectly. But the talks were stalled over what Tehran called Washington's excessive demands. Now, from Tehran, I'm now joined by Fuad Izzati. He's a political analyst. Good to have you with us, sir. So what's Mali talking about? Why bother a resort to that military option that's always been on that table full of options, special demilitary one at the top? Iran is not going to produce any nukes, and that's what's been stressed. It's a religious edict, and that's not the direction Iran is going and toward. And this is also verified by 15, 16 reports by the IAEA. So what's Mali talking about?
Well, you know, he's an American official, so he's under the influence of American arrogance. He thinks by threatening Iran, he can achieve foreign policy goals. You know, it's actually illegal under the UN Charter to threaten other countries. The article talks about the use of force. It's illegal to use force against other countries if the UN Security Council hasn't approved that use of force. But the sentence says threat or use of force. Mm. So threatening other countries is against international law. But we are talking about the U.S. government officials. They break international law every day. And they're showing their true face when it comes to Iran. I think that interview with David Miller at Carnegie Endowment should be watched by your viewers. There are many interesting points beside the fact that he threatens to attack Iran militarily. David Miller asks him about the idea of paying Iranians to engage in a strike, and a number of other interesting suggestions. And then Robert Malley's answer is that they're considering and implementing some of these suggestions. Mm-hmm. So this is another reason the Iranian government calls the rioters foreign-backed, because it seems some of them are getting paid by the United States. And of course, we have had people like this lady, Masiha Nejad, that has been paid more than $600,000. If you go to US Expending, there's a site, you type her name, you can see how much she has been getting paid. So mm-hmm. this is against international law. It's also against the Algiers Accord. The first article of Algiers Accord says that the U.S. Will not interfere in internal affairs of Iran. And they have been violating that accord since its beginning. We are used to this type of American behavior in Iran, so there's nothing surprising here.
Okay, I appreciate your comments. Fadi Zari, political analyst in Tehran. Israeli forces have violently clashed with Palestinian protesters demanding an end to the siege of the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. The regime troops used stun grenades and tear gas to disperse the protesters, who gathered near a checkpoint, calling for it to be reopened. The Fatah resistance movement says the Israeli blockade has even hampered humanitarian aid to reach the city. Nablus has been under military lockdown since October 11th, after a Palestinian operation left an Israeli soldier dead near a settlement. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians have been trapped in the city. They are unable to access health, treatment, and other basic supplies. Fears of political violence are growing in the United States ahead of next week's midterm elections. Security officials expressing concerns about what they're calling unconstrained disinformation and political fury, warning that such factors could spill over into violence. That also followed an attack on House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's mansion that's being seen largely as politically motivated. The man who broke into Pelosi's home and assaulted her husband has been charged with attempted murder and attempted kidnapping of a public official. Meanwhile, a number of political figures and poll workers have reported a surge in threatening messages and intimidation in the lead-up to elections. Security officials have cautioned that extremist and toxic political partisanship pose heightened threats. The elections due on November 8th will decide control of Congress. Time now for the News Review program. Now, Russia saying it's considering further steps in response to what it claims to be Britain's involvement in attacks on the Nord Stream gas pipelines in September.
We also have information that Britain is involved in the sabotage against Nord Stream, or speaking Russian, the act of terrorism, in regards to vital energy infrastructure, and what's more, not Russian. It's very important to note that. But international energy infrastructure.
Peskov stressed that those actions against the gas pipeline should not be left unanswered. Britain's already denied the Russian allegations. London says Moscow is trying to, quote, distract from its military failures in Ukraine. The Russian Defense Ministry said that British Navy personnel have been involved in the attack on its Black Sea fleet, as well as Nord Stream explosions. Massive leaks and unprecedented damage to the pipelines were detected on September 26. Russia and several European countries called the incident an act of sabotage, and later Moscow accused Western countries of not allowing it to participate in the probe into the explosions. So what's all this about? Let me ask our guests. Joining me will be Glenn Diesen, professor of political science with the University of Southeastern Norway in Oslo. Also with me is Scott Ritter. He's a former UN weapons inspector in Iraq. He's joining us from Bethlehem, New York. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. So, Glenn, what's this row over this Nord Stream explosion all about? Why should London do such a thing that Russia is claiming it's done?
Well, London or the United Kingdom has positioned itself as possibly the key opponent of Russia in Europe. So there's many reasons. One would be the main strategic reason of trying to weaken Russia and, by playing a key role in this proxy war. But, of course, they also have their own internal reasons, seeking to play a greater role in Europe after Brexit, so finding a new role for itself, this global Britain. But, obviously, the whole rhetoric around Nord Stream has been, especially in media, quite ridiculous, because the main argument has been all along that, for example, that the United States had nothing to gain from this. And, anyone who claims that the United States had anything to gain with this, they're accused of spreading Russian propaganda. But meanwhile, the United States has consistently been working against trying to prevent the construction of these pipelines. They've even put sanctions on their own allies here in Europe who actually have been building and operating this pipeline. They've been threatening to get rid of these pipelines. And finally, after the attack on these pipelines, it was Anthony Blinken who went out and in the media and said that this was a wonderful opportunity for Europe to replace Russian gas with American gas. So from beginning to end, the media narrative has been quite dishonest. And I think, obviously, there was only three countries who could really have done this. It was either United States, Britain, or Poland. But neither Britain nor Poland could have done it without a green light from the United States. So the way I see it is, it's quite possible that Britain, again, was behind this.
All right. Scott Ritter, how do you look at this story? If the media is wrong, what's right?
No, I mean, I agree 100%. First of all, Russia did not do this. That's as plain as the nose on my face, and it's a rather big nose. So, to say that Russia did this is to say that Russia attacked its own strategic interests. Despite everything that Europe has done in terms of sanctioning Russian energy, Russia has always been open to the possibility of resuming energy supplies, and indeed has been advocating a return to a situation where Europe was once again receiving Russian energy. Russia was advocating openly for Germany to turn on the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. So at this moment where German public opinion is starting to put pressure on the German government to implement policies that would do exactly what Russia wanted done, we're now led to believe that Russia would throw this all away by sabotaging the pipelines that provide Russian gas to Germany and Europe. It's an absurdity in the extreme. But why they get away with it is that the mainstream media has lost the ability to carry out independent investigative journalism to ask the relevant questions, and instead have become little more than stenographers for whatever government spin is put out by Great Britain, the United States, Poland, Ukraine, and others. And that's what this is. This is one giant propaganda exercise where the media is a compliant partner with the parties that are spreading this disinformation. This isn't Russian disinformation. This is British disinformation, American disinformation.
Okay. Glenn, some Western states came out and said that this is an act of sabotage. Later on, when they started the probes into the explosions on Nord Stream, then they didn't allow Russia to pitch in. Why is that?
Well, the official argument would be, of course, that they see Russia as the adversary here, and also they wouldn't want to for Russia to do anything with the wrong with the investigation. But we saw the similar thing with after the MH17, the Malaysian flight shut down over Donbass. You know, Russia's not supposed to be involved with anything, which kind of discredits a lot of this investigation. But my personal assumption is, as well, Mr. Ritter pointed out, this is quite obviously not Russia has not attacked its own gas pipelines. So if I was trying to cover it up, I wouldn't want anyone else to. I wouldn't want to invite the Russians either to investigate this. But it could be quite a scandal, because if it was Britain or the United States, either way, attacking a key gas pipeline which weakens Germany in this way could cause a lot of fragmentation within the West. Now, obviously, I think the Germans are quite aware that this was, you know, it was not one of their adversaries, but one of their allies who did this attack. So I can't imagine any reason whatsoever why Russia would do this. I mean, after all these years of America and Britain warning that the Nord Stream 2, you know, is a dangerous source of Russian income and this nefarious influence in Europe, and then now suddenly we're told that no, actually attack Russia, destroying its own pipeline is part of this brilliant Russian playbook. And, you know, they're also accused of course, bombing their own nuclear power plants, which is also part of this brilliant Russian playbook. They just have these catchphrases, which they tend to spew out every time something wouldn't necessarily make sense, just suggest that it's part of a grand, you know, it's common thread, you know, repeated actions by Russia, which, again, it's a substitute for common sense, in my view, though.
Okay, I appreciate your comments and insight. Glenn Deason, Oslo, and Scott Ritter in Bethlehem, New York. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. With the continuation of the crimes of the Israeli regime against oppressed Palestinians in the occupied territories, almost all human rights organizations have acknowledged that these people are facing a racist and apartheid regime that increases its crimes and colonial measures day by day. Recently, some United Nations human rights officials and five former European ministers have labeled Israel as a racist and apartheid regime. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Middle East Monitor has more for us. The United Nations Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territories says it will investigate apartheid charges against Israel, stoking serious fears among Zionist authorities that the probe would recognize the regime as apartheid due to its ongoing atrocities against Palestinians. The three members of the commission said during a briefing at the United Nations in New York on Thursday, 27th of October, that future reports will investigate apartheid by Israel. They said the investigation has so far focused on the root causes of the conflict, which they ascribe to Israel's illegal presence in the occupied West Bank. Navi Pillay, a former United Nations human rights chief who chairs the commission, called apartheid a manifestation of the occupation. Navi Pillay said, "We're focusing on the root cause, which is the occupation, and part of its lies, and part of it lies in apartheid." She added, "We will be coming to that. That's the beauty of this open-ended mandate. It gives us the scope." The United Nations Human Rights Council, Human Rights Watch, and other international human rights organizations have accused the Israeli regime of apartheid in the past 2 years. Earlier this year, reports emerged that the Israeli Foreign Ministry was planning a campaign to head off accusations of apartheid by the United Nations Commission. A leaked cable reportedly revealed Israeli officials were concerned about the damage the United Nations Commission's first report could do if it referred to Israel as an apartheid regime. The Commission presented its latest report to the United Nations General Assembly on Thursday, 27th of October. The 28-page report condemns the Israeli regime for violating international laws by making its control over the occupied West Bank permanent and by annexing Palestinian-owned land in the occupied city of Al-Quds and the West Bank, as well as the Syrian land of the Golan Heights. It also slams Israel for discriminatory policies against Arab citizens, stealing natural resources, and gender-based violence against Palestinian women. In March of 2021, former International Criminal Court Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda announced in a statement the launch of war crimes investigation in the Palestinian territories, which have been under Israeli occupation since 1967. The probe is expected to include the 2014 Israeli military onslaught against the Gaza Strip, the Great March of Return demonstrations in 2018, and the Israeli settlement expansion across the Palestinian lands, including eastern Al-Quds. Turkey's Anadolu news agency covers the same story from a different angle. A group of former European ministers have acknowledged that Israel's policies and practices against the Palestinians amount to the crime of apartheid and called on the international community to hold the Israeli occupation regime to account. The group, in a letter published in the French newspaper Le Monde, said, "We must acknowledge that Israel's policies against Palestinians amount to the crime of apartheid." The former ministers include Danish politician Mogens Liketoft, Finnish politician Erkki Sakari Tuomioja, Slovenian lawmaker Ivo Vajgl, Hubert Vedrine, a French socialist politician, and member of the British House of Lords, Baroness Sayida Hossein Warsi. The letter stressed, "We see no alternative but to acknowledge that Israel's policies and practices against the Palestinians living in the West Bank, eastern Al-Quds and Gaza amount to the crime of apartheid." The group argued that the international community's reluctance to hold Israel to account over its crimes poses a grave threat to the rules-based order which is claiming to defend innocent people under siege and occupation. The group said the international community has rallied behind the multilateralism and the need to adhere to international law and protect human rights. Indeed, it is the only way forward in an increasingly polarized global landscape. Referring to Israel's occupation of Palestine, the group added, "At the same time, we are reminded how the international community has too often remained silent and failed to act in the face of grave violations of international law and impunity for serious abuses in other contexts." They stress that safeguarding the international legal order means applying principles uniformly and consistently. The letter slams successive Western governments for failing to uphold the international community's consensus regarding the illegality and immorality of over five decades of Israeli occupation. Although this principle is said to form the backbone of European policy and governs its relationship with the Israeli regime, the apartheid regime has never faced any consequences for its myriad violations of international laws. The website of the Middle East Eye has also covered the same story. The United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territories said in a report released to the public recently that Israel's actions against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank amount to persecution. The United Nations Special Rapporteur, Francesca Albanese, wrote, "Realizing the inalienable right of the Palestinian people to self-determination requires dismantling once and for all the Israeli settler colonial occupation and its apartheid practices." The report, dated 21st of September 2022, details Israeli effort to stamp out the Palestinian collective identity and sovereignty, noting the 13th of May 2022 attack by the Israeli military on Palestinian pallbearers carrying their national flag during the funeral of the murdered journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Francesca Albanese also documents the use of lethal force against journalists and humanitarian workers critical of Israel, along with the detention of Palestinian political leaders. The report discusses the recent case of Salah Hamouri, a French-Palestinian lawyer from the city of Al-Quds, who was detained without charges or trial since 7th of March 2022 on allegations of terrorism. According to the report, almost 4,500 Palestinians are currently detained, 730 of them without any charge and largely based on secret evidence. While Palestinian children as young as 12 have been victims of arbitrary arrest and detention, 500 to 700 Palestinian minors are held every year by the Israeli regime. Francesca Albanese critiqued efforts by regional states to normalize their ties with Israel, calling the peacemaking attempts ineffective because they have not focused their approaches on human rights, particularly the right to self-determination, and have overlooked the apartheid and the settler colonial underpinnings of the Israeli occupation.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and He's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your problems, questions you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. A child is like a white paper on which you can write good things or bad things. Entire personality of a child is developed by the parents, by the upbringing they do. And in this program, we try to provide all the necessary information that is required to bring up your child in the best possible way. The answers of your questions are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member of Al Mustafa University and researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
We are here to discuss about ethical development today. But before we enter ethical development, Professor Nakavi, I would want you to give us another brief account of worldview of development.
So, as we mentioned previously in one of the sessions, that when we talk about the development of the ideological development, we are talking about the development of the worldview, the understanding about the universe. It's a cognitive understanding. It's understanding through cognition. Therefore, cognitive development is very important.
Yeah.
If I have been able to develop, my child has developed that cognitive faculty and is able to realize what is true and correct and make the proper judgments and reach the proper conclusions, is able to logically rationalize things, that is very important for the development of the worldview.
Okay.
Of course, we believe that within us, naturally, Allah Almighty has created this fitrah in us. We have this inherent fitrah, divine fitrah, the divine nature of mankind. With that breathing of the soul of Allah Almighty, by birth, by virtue of being a human being, we are inclined towards perfection and the absolute being. That exactly. is Allah Almighty. But to realize what that perfection and absolute being is,
it takes efforts.
It requires this cognitive understanding.
Okay.
To be able to channelize this understanding which is there deep down in us, in okay. our very natural birth, in our very nature, intrinsic in our human nature, is godliness.
Okay.
We know God, we love God. But till it comes out in the form of a comprehensive worldview, you cannot consider that to be, you cannot be assured of the fact that we will abide by that worldview. We shall remain committed to that worldview. So we need cognitive development to make a proper worldview.
Yeah.
And then, so that is cognition.
Okay.
But then when we want to have faith about that worldview, there emotions also come into play.
All right.
So emotional development is required for the development of the faith in the worldview that we have, because we may be able to rationalize and philosophize the fact that God exists, that he has these attributes, he is the creator, he is our Lord, he is to be worshipped, he sustains us at each and every moment of our existence. There's no doubt about that. Philosophically, rationally, we can deduce that. But do we have faith in that? That is important.
That's important.
As a result of that worldview, is the love, the love of Allah Almighty being, you know, is it going into that direction of our understanding? Love and hate are deviating from that. So the emotional development is important.
Is playing a part over there. Well, we'll talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Naqavi and we're talking about ethical development. Professor Naqavi, before going to the break, you gave us a brief of world wave development. You said cognitive development about the world wave. When we realize in that our ultimate goal is to reach closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, emotional development takes a part in because faith is involved. And when there is faith, there's emotional development as well.
And we were talking about the fact that actually, whatever, as we mentioned, deep in our hearts, there's only one thing which has to be loved. The object of our love is Allah Almighty. But that does not negate our love for our parents, does not negate our love for our siblings, it does not negate our love for our children, because the love of these things emanates from the love of God. It should come out of that fountainhead. So emotions have to be channelized and managed according to that worldview. And then this worldview has to be changed into ideology and values and things which are valuable to us in the sense that they are actions or things which have to be performed. For example, one of the basic values, apart from the fact that we have faith in Allah Almighty or we have faith in Allah Almighty or we should have faith in Allah Almighty, we have to carry out things which are good according to Allah Almighty's creation or His legislation. For example, worshipping Allah Almighty, being obedient to Him, is a value which emanates from the fact that He's our Lord. Yeah. So worldview changes into ideology, or it is translated into ideology, and we are committed to that we have to worship Him, we have to obey Him, not only in the specific sense of worship that we carry out in prayers, but worshipping Him and obey Him in all aspects of our lives. And therefore, this ideology, what is good and what is bad, what is evil, what is good, wrong and right, evil and good, this
love and hatred.
And love and hatred according to these things which are valuable. Love should come towards Allah, and things which are have to be carried out, what ought to be carried out because of our belief in Allah Almighty, then our love and hatred should get channelized into the actions which are based on these values. So ethical and moral development is the understanding of what is good and what is bad.
And when parents are reading that aloud in that ziyara, inni salmul liman salamakum, that develops that I love what you love.
And you need to inculcate in them and in our children that, look, goodness, evil is something which is inherent, as we believe, as Shia Muslims. We believe that goodness and evil are inherent in actions. And Allah Almighty makes them obligatory because they have inherent goodness. An action is good because it is based on justice. An action is evil because it is based on
oppression
and tyranny. So the love for these things emanates from the love of Allah Almighty.
Exactly.
And this is where ethical and morals are developed.
Yes. We'll talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Naqavi and we're discussing ethical development. Yes, Professor Naqavi, you said love, the concept of hatredness, what is good, what is evil. This is all developed and in a child and it comes in the ethical development. And now I would want to ask you about the behavior. How do we teach our child how to behave, how to show your ethics as Muslims?
So behavior is managed by the laws that Allah Almighty has legislated. What we talk about, when we talk about fiqh, when we talk about ahkam, practical laws, we are talking about those norms which have to be followed practically, so that those ethical principles are strengthened in us. I mean, these ethical values which are there as a part of that worldview, and then the practices which come as a result of those values are managed or controlled or regulated by the ahkam. So we need to teach our children the ahkam.
Okay.
The laws, the practical laws of worship and interacting with other human beings.
There and are so how many, to interact, basically.
How to interact. There's a vast, this is a very vast subject.
Yeah.
Practical laws about worshipping Allah, practical laws about dealing with other human beings, transactions, business, sports, and everything, every human action has is controlled and regulated by Islamic laws. Islamic laws, when you practice those laws, those values within you, the attributes, the godly attributes within you are strengthened.
Yeah.
So they, and as a result of that, your faith in Allah is strengthened.
Yeah.
So this is, it works in a loop.
Yeah.
Worldview leads to faith. Faith leads to taqwa and commitment to those values. And taqwa leads to actions, behavior, which are regulated by fiqh. And there, physical development is comes into play, because many of our actions, even worship that we carry out in the form of prayers, the physical faculties have to be intact to carry out so many things.
And in a very playway method, we can teach them very divine things, like, you know, there are parents who say to their children that, if you get me this thing, I'll give you one chocolate. If you give me more things, if you help me more in the kitchen, or if you help me more in cleaning the room, I'll give you two chocolates. In the same way, we can teach a child that if you start your conversation with salam, and if you're the starter, you'll get, there are these many rewards for the one who starts it, and there are these many rewards for the one who answers it. So you're basically teaching your child here how to be very, very down to earth. And as a Muslim, one has to be down to the earth. Thank you so much, Professor Naqavi, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you want to listen to our programs again, please go back to our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. If you have any questions, any suggestions, any comments for our program, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also search us on our social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. And when you go to our official website, parstoday.com, you'll find a tab Call of Islam. Over there, you can find our programs. Until another session, fi amanullah, God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
IRIB English Radio. Thank you. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
No doubt, Palestinians are the only owners of the land of Palestine, which is partly occupied by the fabricated regime of Israel. The Zionist regime, which is after ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, is now working to expel Palestinians from Masafer Yatta in the West Bank by making living conditions for its residents intolerable. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media websites for further details. Stay tuned, please. Electronic Intifada wrote, a prominent Israeli human rights group is calling on Karim Khan, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, ICC, to urgently intervene to prevent the expulsion of Palestinians from a rural area of the West Bank. In a letter delivered recently, Betzlem requested Khan's urgent intervention to prevent the Zionist regime from continuing to carry out this policy, and to clarify that forcible transfer constitutes a war crime under the Rome Statute, the founding treaty of the International Criminal Court. The Zionist regime seeks to expel some 1,000 Palestinians from Masafer Yatta in the West Bank's South Al-Khalil Hills by making the conditions they live in so unbearable they are forced to leave the area they have lived in for generations, Betzlem states in his letter. While these efforts have been underway for decades, the Zionist regime has recently massively stepped them up in scope, severity, and frequency. Those efforts were accelerated after the Zionist regime's high court rejected a legal challenge to the plans to turn the area into the military training zone. One of the Israeli regime judges who issued the verdict is a settler who was born in the UK and lives in a Jewish-only colony in the West Bank built in violation of international law. Ariel Sharon, then Zionist regime's agriculture minister, admitted in 1981 that the area was declared a firing zone for the purpose of displacing Palestinians from their land so it may be seized by the Israeli regime. The High Court's ruling in May concluded 2 decades of challenges mounted by Palestinians in Masafer Yatta. Since 2006, the fabricated regime of Israel destroyed nearly 70 residential structures in these communities that were home to 355 people, 175 of them minors, according to Betzlem. The group has also documented the demolition of 32 non-residential structures in these communities. Violence by Jewish settlers also serves the regime's aim of pushing Palestinians off their land in Masafer Yatta. Betzalem states, Jewish settlers physically assault Palestinian shepherds and use their land, sabotage water sources and enter homes, among other violent acts, with full state backing and often active participation of Israeli soldiers and police. According to B'Tselem, since the High Court ruling earlier this year, life for Palestinian residents has become a nightmare. The Zionist regime's aim, the rights group says, is to make Palestinian lives miserable enough. So they will leave their homes and land, and the state will take over the area. The Zionist regime has conducted military training exercises involving tanks and live fire in the area. The military has confiscated vehicles and imposed roadblocks hindering Palestinians in the rural area from accessing nearby population centers. B'Tselem said soldiers at roadblocks make it difficult and often outright prevent access to humanitarian agencies, human rights organizations, activists, journalists, and diplomats. An intervention by Khan's predecessor, Fatou Bensouda, is believed to have discouraged the Zionist regime from destroying Khan al-Ahmar, a Bedouin community in the West Bank. Bensouda warned the Zionist regime in 2018 that the planned eviction of Khan al-Ahmar would constitute a war crime. Despite this warning, several lawmakers pledged to destroy the village while campaigning for votes during the Zionist regime's last general election. Before her term as ICC chief prosecutor ended last year, Bensouda opened a formal investigation into war crimes in the West Bank and Gaza Strip amid fierce opposition and hostility from the Zionist regime and the U.S. Israel's settlement enterprise in the West Bank is likely a primary focus of the ICC investigation. The Israeli regime's officials responsible for executing policy in Masafer Yatab may be treated as suspects by the court, which tries individuals rather than states. According to B'Tselem, those responsible include Israeli regime's prime minister, war minister, military chief of staff, and the high court judges who legally sanctioned the policy. Even though the ICC opened an investigation in Palestine last year, international justice remains an uphill battle. Palestinian human rights groups have expressed frustration that since the beginning of his term as chief prosecutor last June, Khan, Britain's nominee for the post, the ICC investigation in Palestine, hasn't moved forward. The chief prosecutor, who was nominated for his post by the UK, which also opposes the ICC investigation in Palestine, has made no public statement according to Israeli regime recently banning and raiding offices of Palestinian human rights groups that have submitted evidence files to the court on behalf of victims. During his visit to Al-Quds in July, U.S. President Joe Biden affirmed that Washington would work with Tel Aviv to combat all efforts to boycott or delegitimize Israel, to deny its right to self-defense, or to unfairly single it out in any forum, including at the United Nations or International Criminal Court, Biden claimed. Also, the website of Palestine Chronicle wrote, Israeli human rights group B'Tselem has called on the International Criminal Court ICC prosecutor Karim Khan to urgently intervene to stop Israel from evicting Palestinians from their homes and land in Masafer Yatab, the official Palestinian news agency Wafa reported. Israeli regime authorities are planning the eviction of some 1,000 Palestinian inhabitants of Masafer Yatah, a rural area located south of Al-Khalil in the occupied West Bank, in order to create a military firing zone for Israeli regime occupation forces. 8 villages, including 4 schools, clinics, and hundreds of other structures in the area, are slated for demolition. The fabricated regime of Israel has been trying to drive these communities out for decades, but has recently escalated its actions in scope, severity, and frequency following the May 2022 ruling by the Zionist regime Supreme Court. The ruling, which contravened international law provisions and basic moral principles, reached the conclusion that the residents have no right to live on the land and there is no legal impediment to expelling them. Israel has made the residents' lives a nightmare. They suffer daily threats by soldiers and settlers to their bodies and property, as well as noise and pollution hazards, routine damage to infrastructure, incessant invasion of their privacy, and constant uncertainty over their future, said Betzalem in a statement. The statement added, Israel is also working to cut these small communities off from their surroundings, with the military placing roadblocks, confiscating cars, and hindering activists, journalists, and diplomats from accessing the area.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.